Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim, who will be joining me for the next Economist Mom segment. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The Trump administration is applying pressure to see the nation's debt limit increased. In a letter to Congress, the Treasury Secretary warned of a possible default on debt in early September, and he encouraged policymakers to increase the limit before the August recess as a result. Congressional leaders see the need for a debt limit increase, but have pushed back on a clean increase with standalone legislation. They are instead pushing for a bipartisan agreement that increases both the debt limit and discretionary spending levels for the next 2 years. Potentially slowing things down is the Treasury Secretary's call for the cost of higher discretionary spending caps to be offset with spending cuts or revenue increases, which has historically been the path taken. Senate appropriators are now unlikely to work on any of their fiscal year 2020 spending bills before the August recess. If that becomes reality, it would be the slowest start to the Senate appropriations process in a few decades, increasing the likelihood of a stopgap funding bill to avoid another government shutdown. The House is scheduled to adjourn for the summer by July 26th and the Senate by August 2nd. Both parties currently stand far apart on terms for a spending deal, but at least they're currently talking. The House, on a vote of 402-12, passed legislation that would make permanent the fund for first responders and other victims of the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. It also provides the funds necessary to pay all eligible claims, but as written, the measure would violate the House's PAYGO rule, and Congress has yet to identify a way to pay for the measure that could cost $10 billion over the next decade and billions more beyond that. The Senate will likely consider the bill soon, possibly having a floor vote before the August recess. The House may vote this week to repeal what has been labeled the Cadillac tax in the Affordable Care Act, which is a 40% surcharge on high-cost employer-sponsored health plans. The tax, which was intended to help pay for the ACA, has been widely opposed and has already been delayed until 2022. The CBO estimates that repealing the tax would result in $193 billion in lost revenue over the next decade. It is unknown whether the Senate would consider the bill if it passes the House. In the mid-session review released by the White House, they painted a budget outlook that is slightly better than its March budget proposal. The Office of Management and Budget now expects this year's budget deficit to come in at just over $1 trillion, down $91 billion from its forecast earlier this year, with the next 10 years of deficits down a total of $414 billion. Both figures are driven largely by changes in projected costs of servicing our debt due to low interest rates. Some mandatory spending is expected to be lower because of lower inflation. Much of the reduced spending is also offset by a forecast of lower tax revenue. A tax credit originally designed for alternative fuels to encourage renewable energy sources as a part of a surface transportation law in 2005 and expired in 2017 is being pursued retroactively by oil refiners. The credit of more than $500 million claimed by just two companies could equal the entire estimated cost of the credit for 2017, and if a variety of claims and lawsuits are successful, the credit could end up costing between $10 and $18 billion. The Trump administration's push to speed up getting astronauts back to the moon could likely run into funding issues. NASA has asked Congress for an extra $1.6 billion in fiscal year 2020 to achieve the proposed 2024 goal of getting back on the moon. Some policymakers view the White House's push as an election year stunt to excite voters. The House has not included the funding, and the Senate has yet to address the matter. Up next, Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim will join me for our Economist Mom segment. We will discuss real-world policy and program changes for the evolving economy. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim for our Economist Mom segment. Diane is a principal at the District Economics Group, and congratulations are in order as she just recently got married. So, Diane, welcome and congratulations.
Thanks, Chase. Yes, I got married to, full disclosure, to Bill Gale, the recent author of Fiscal Therapy.
Which, by the way, I'd like to also throw in, it's a great book and people should read it.
It is a great book.
Not to ignore you, Bob, welcome back to the show as well.
Oh, thanks, Chase. I don't have anything particularly exciting to end like that. I did go to Diane and Bill's wedding, yes. So I can say that.
Yeah. I'm hoping there will be a video that surfaces of you dancing at the wedding, but that's neither here nor there.
I don't think there was one. Yes.
It doesn't exist.
It does not exist, yes.
That's what they all say. I wanted to have you back on the show, Diane, for the Economist Mom segment to pick up a little bit on what we had been talking about in prior segments about the evolving economy, the changing nature of work, in part because I wanted us to talk about some specific real-world policy and program changes or strategies that might help either the private sector or our federal government adapt to that evolving economy. And you said in the past, tying certain programs to individuals instead of the traditional employer-employee relationship would actually be helpful. Why is that?
Well, because, you know, today, in today's workplace, jobs are not held for, you know, entire careers like they were, like was more commonplace in the, you know, decades ago. And so people don't stay in one job for their entire career. Even if they stay for a few years and go on to another job in a few years, there are costs to moving from one employer to another because your health insurance benefits, your retirement savings benefits are tied to that particular employer, that your employer sets up those programs for you and access to those programs and often subsidizes those programs because the government in turn subsidizing their employees' benefits. So it makes it costly for people to even move from one traditional employer to another because they have to break that relationship and start a new one. Often employment comes with vesting periods where you can't get access to an employer's contribution to your retirement savings until you've worked there for a number of years. So it kind of penalizes people that either change jobs frequently and don't have enough time in vested status, or it encourages or discourages people from switching jobs, even when they might have a better opportunity to come up. It discourages them from moving more quickly than is financially beneficial to them. It also just penalizes people who are kind of in the gig economy or the, you know, independent worker, non-traditional work relationships, if they're independent contractors, if they're paid, you know, on a piecework basis, that what we tend to label gig, temporary employees. It tends to penalize them because usually if you're part-time or a temporary worker, or if you're an independent contractor being paid through a 1099 form, tax form, rather than a W-2, you tend to not have benefits tied to work. You're not provided those benefits. So because we're so, our major benefit programs come through traditional full-time employment with a traditional employer, it makes it difficult for the broad class of Americans to achieve economic security, given that more and more people are not in those traditional relationships these days.
You mentioned health care benefits, retirement benefits. Are there any other areas of benefits or aspects of that traditional employer-employee relationship that you think we should be talking about today in terms of a strategy to change them?
Like child care benefits, maternity leave. You know, there are a lot of household formation issues, supports to the families that can only come if you are working for an employer that provides, you know, paid time off or even unpaid time off. You know, that's another benefit that we don't tend to put a monetary value on because it's unpaid leave. But even unpaid leave contributes to economic security. Like if you're a new mother and or a father and you know that you can take some time off work, whether paid or unpaid, but come back to your job even if you've been out of the job for several months, that's worth so much money. You know, that's a huge economic benefit that doesn't have a financial cost if you're on unpaid leave. And those are sort of guarantees that only come from your employer. You know, you in no other situation are you guaranteed, a job after you take maternity leave than if you already have a job with a traditional employer.
In the gig economy, Diane, and those who function in sort of the 1099 individual mm-hmm. contractor working reality, how do those individuals go about getting these benefits, whether it's retirement or health care or any other kind of leave? Is there a private sector stopgap there, or is it really just a massive hole that's growing?
Well, sure. And any individual on their own, they can choose to open up a retirement savings account on their own, but you're not going to have an employer contributing to it. You probably don't have as good access to the same kinds of returns. And health insurance, you can go in the individual market, you can go in the exchange market and buy your own non-group health insurance policy, but those are very expensive. So compared to if your employer is providing you health insurance, usually the employer contributes a fraction, a significant fraction, sometimes all of your premium. And they're doing so willingly because they can deduct it as a cost from their taxes. So, you're just at a huge disadvantage given the current tax system and benefit system. You're at a huge disadvantage when you're just one person trying to save on your own and pay for your own health insurance. It's very difficult without that traditional employer.
You know, there is the issue of automatic enrollment, which a lot of employers employ, and a lot of people think that it should be done more broadly to encourage people encourage people to save more if you had automatic enrollment and savings plans, because a lot of people don't take advantage of the plans that are on offer. But if you're not tied to a particular employer, there's no mechanism. There's no automatic enrollment plan. That's one of the arguments we used to make for having a, careful how I say this because I don't want people to misconstrue it, a private account component to Social Security.
Right.
And that's different from privatizing Social Security and turning it into a program, but having a component of the system where workers would, in effect, contribute almost on a guaranteed basis, part of the payroll tax would go into this savings plan, and you could make it optional. So,
well, and Social Security in general actually is a retirement savings plan. In effect, a retirement savings plan that goes with you even as you switch jobs. But it still requires that you have some relationship with the workforce. Right. You have to have a work history to have savings or be entitled to Social Security benefits in retirement. So that gets rid of the problem of, at least for that basic level Social Security benefits, it provides retirement savings that isn't tied to a particular employer, but it doesn't help the people that don't have those regular work histories.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim. In our recurring segment, The Economist Mom, we're discussing real-world policy and program changes for the evolving economy. And I want to pick up on what both of you were just discussing. You touched on some really important issues in health care and retirement security. And one sort of demographic reality that we're seeing out there, and this might get into a little bit of politics, but I believe at this point all the baby boomers are at least 55. And no elected official is going to reform any of these programs in such a way that harms someone right on the cusp of retirement and enrolling in many of those programs. So I'm going to ask this question with that reality sort of in perspective. When you're looking at reforming, and we'll start with Social Security, then I want to talk about healthcare. When you're reforming Social Security, perhaps for up-and-coming generations and helping that generation plan for its retirement beyond the traditional employer-employee relationship, and you were just starting to get in there, are there other options besides just having a private account in conjunction with the Social Security system?
Well, I mean, we could make the Social Security benefit structure more progressive, and that's often been part of proposals to reform Social Security. It's not just to increase revenues relative to costs, but to change the structure of the cost so that relatively more benefits would go toward lower income households. I mean, I think given the fact that many low income households only have Social Security income as their income during retirement, it kind of underscores the need to do something with the Social Security benefit structure where the benefits will go more toward those where it really makes a difference. Because high income households currently are entitled to high benefits, relatively high benefits, because they have relatively high earnings histories, and so your Social Security benefits are tied to your highest paid work years, and it's a progressive structure in that it's not as a fraction of income, the replacement rate is not as high for higher income households than for lower income households, but in dollar terms it's still true that high income households get a lot of Social Security benefits in absolute dollar terms, and a lot of them, that's like peanuts compared to what they've saved on their own in their retirement, in their private retirement savings account. So I think that for reform purposes, experts always recommend not just better aligning cost to benefits, but also, or cost to revenues, rather taxes, but also changing the progressivity of it, making it a little bit more progressive.
Yeah, things have changed a lot. When you look at the income distribution, it's skewed so much more heavily towards the top that it does produce this anomaly where, a certain portion, a greater portion of the benefits are being earned by people who need them the least. So that is we've always argued for a more progressive benefit structure. But I think the case is even stronger now. The other thing that makes it a little bit easier is the fact that you mentioned that the baby boomers have now, the youngest baby boomer will reach 55 this year.
Yeah.
And that is a good thing because we can concentrate reform efforts on the future. It's often said that if you're 55 and older, you'd be exempted from changes. I mean, people have kind of used that because you have to phase in changes to a program like Social Security. You can't change it on a dime because people have been planning on benefits their whole career. So you have to phase in changes. And so it's usually been thought that anybody 55 or over would be exempt. So the whining, self-centered baby boomers, of which I am one, seems to have skated and postponed reforms long enough that more of it will be dumped on your generation. But I do think that if we look at exchanges that we can phase into the benefit formula that would probably exempt the boomers now, because it would be, aside from certain changes in the indexing of benefits, whether you use CPI or change CPI or some of these technical things, that would affect current beneficiaries, but most of the other things would not. So
It does make it more costly.
Yes,
on the remaining generations.
That's the bad news, and the good news is that it might make something
more feasible, because they're taking off the get out of the way. The baby boomers have nothing to complain about.
Yeah.
So stay out of the
argument.
That's
right. You can't complain. It's not your problem. So when you get that direct mail outrage at Social Security reform, you can toss it in the trash.
I'm sure AARP will be happy to hear that.
Well, they're not the big, I should say, in AARP's defense, they don't. They're not the prime.
They're not
transgressors in that regard.
Right.
Well, this sort of, I want to stay on this generational perspective here before we go to our break. If we're looking at potentially the reality that my generation and generations after us will pay more toward the system and get less out of it relative to other generations. So, for instance, to stabilize Social Security, you have to reduce the amount of benefits going forward, not impacting baby boomers, but perhaps impacting my generation and thereafter. What can be done to encourage my generation or enable my generation to save more for retirement outside of Social Security at a time when this relationship with employers is changing to where it might fall almost entirely on us without any help from an employer?
Yeah, well, I think this is where we don't look to government so much, but we look to, you know, the nonprofit sector and community organizations and educational institutions and, you know, grassroots organizations like the Concord Coalition to kind of promote greater awareness about the more challenging economic times ahead for, you know, younger generations, and the importance, the value of saving early. And, you know, I think that there are private companies that are trying to encourage, you know, more savvy personal finance among young people through easy-to-use apps. Younger generations are very responsive to, you know, customized content online that helps them monitor their own savings and encourages them by showing them their progress. So I think we're, you know, the younger generations are just used to doing a lot of things on their own independently and having a lot of data in front of them. And I think that the way young people are going to be better prepared for the future, better prepared than baby boomers, is they take more personal responsibility because they're more personally engaged in their financial future than baby boomers were. So baby boomers were the passive ones. You just go to work every day. You punch the time clock. Your employer takes care of how much you're putting in your retirement savings account. You know, I feel like baby boomer generation is sort of like, you know, we're just programmed to go to work, come home, cook dinner. But the younger generations, they're just much more aware of every aspect of their lives and their finances, I feel, for just seeing what my kids do with their own financial planning. So I think that the younger generation is going to be just fine. I think it's unfair that in terms of government finances that we've placed this heavy burden on them relative to the relatively light burden baby boomers have had. But I don't believe that the younger generations are going to be in financial trouble. I think they're very resourceful, more resourceful and more engaged in their financial situation than their parents were.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim in our recurring segment, The Economist Mom. We've been discussing real-world policy and program changes for the evolving economy. We will pick up on our conversation after the break, specifically jumping into healthcare. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist mom, Diane Lim. Diane is a principal at the District Economics Group. She and Bob are regular contributors on the show. And we're picking up where we left off in our last segment, discussing real-world policy and program changes for the evolving economy. Diane, I feel like I could have said so much more in addition to what you said at the end of the last segment, but instead, for the sake of time, I'm going to switch to a new topic, and that is healthcare. It's something we were referring to earlier on in terms of a benefit that might be struggling a bit as this traditional employer-employee relationship changes in the economy. Where do you see the provision of healthcare or even health insurance going in the future? Where can we make changes?
Well, I think we need to make health insurance more affordable for people who don't have an employer subsidizing it and the government subsidizing it. So I see a lot of desire for more universal access to health insurance coverage. I think that it's not necessarily going to be just alternative models of health insurance, but it could be just alternative methods of financing health care for Americans that come up that don't really, that are separate from the insurance system. So I think that it's part of this general feeling that when you don't have a traditional employment relationship, you're disadvantaged. It costs a lot more to do it on your own. It's a lot more difficult to find policies on your own that aren't handed to you as defaults from an employer. And it's part of, you know, when we talk about broader benefits, we think about, well, if you're going to tie benefits not to the, if you're going to avoid tying benefits to a criterion like you have a regular employment relationship, then the more you loosen the how people qualify for those benefits, the more it's moving toward the universal direction and the more costly it becomes. So then you're faced with this difficult trade-off, like if you're expanding coverage and you're trying to spend the same amount of money, you're going to have to reduce the per-person benefit. So this is the challenge of trying to make any benefit system, whether it's health insurance or retirement savings or, you know, paid maternity leave, any kind of universal system, college education, anything more universal, the trade-off is, well, then you're not going to be able to be as generous as you are currently are to the people who do currently benefit from those programs. Or if you're going to try to be as generous, this is going to be wildly costly, you know, to expand it in a universal way. So that's the problem, is that economists don't like, kind of means-tested programs or targeted programs, because if they're targeted in a way that is, like, conditional on income, we worry about disincentives. Like, you know, if we say, let's only give the benefit to lower-income people, then we worry that that's going to make people not have the incentive to become higher-income people, which actually is ludicrous. But that is the theoretical, you know, presumption. So economists are very sensitive to this trade-off between targeting benefits or targeting taxes and preserving, basically making the tax and benefit system as neutral to economic decisions as possible, because we don't like people distorting their, you know, people's decisions getting distorted by policy and away from what's truly, you know, what truly makes sense from an economic perspective or from a social, psychological perspective for the family. It's a trade-off. I don't think we can, I just don't know how the math works out that we provide, you know, universal health care, universal college education, universal retirement, you know, income, in a way, universal, like, basic income, in a way that is realistic, like, from a budgetary perspective.
Well, wasn't the attempt by the Affordable Care Act to sort of split, I don't want to say split the difference, but it was to expand coverage, not to make it universal, but to make it affordable for people who were not tied to the workplace and did not have employer-provided coverage. And that was the main invention of the Affordable Care Act, was the marketplaces. Because one of the problems with individual, there really is not, was before the ACA, not an individual health market that was particularly viable. I mean, people could buy very cheap insurance, but it was very, very expensive and didn't cover a whole lot. So the attempt in the ACA was to create something that hadn't existed before, which was an affordable healthcare market for private insurance. People without employer-provided insurance.
It's not considered affordable for a lot of people still. I mean, relative to employer-provided insurance, right? So it required trying to get some subsidization of those individual exchange policy costs, right? And it requires people enrolling, otherwise paying a penalty for not enrolling, right? And it's all those things that help reduce the cost of the program, which is like, oh, we're going to collect taxes on some premiums, and that's going to help reduce the cost of the individual market policies, or we're going to penalize people tax people if they don't enroll, if they're an employer that does not enroll. I think those are the parts of the ACA that keep falling apart, right?
Right, all the enforcement.
All the things that provide the revenue that would pay for subsidizing the cost of the exchange policies, they just get postponed or they get overturned, right? So the problem is, in order to make it affordable for all Americans to purchase health insurance, someone's got to pay something somewhere. Someone's got to pay some more from right somewhere else.
Well, that triggers a thought about one of my pet peeves at the moment, which is the debate about Medicare for all.
Yeah.
Because I don't like the term, because nobody is actually proposing, literally, Medicare for all. It's, in my view, a marketing device for universal coverage. So I would rather say universal coverage.
Right.
Medicare is, Medicare has premiums. Medicare has a dedicated payroll tax. Medicare has copays. Medicare has private insurance, which is a big part of Medicare. Medicare Part
right.
C, which people sign up for, is the fastest growing part of Medicare, is a subsidized private insurance, and it doesn't cover everything. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of things that Medicare doesn't cover. So the proponents of what is generally viewed as Medicare for all are proposing benefit expansions and the elimination of private insurance and the elimination of copays and premiums. And this seems like kind of a nirvana that would be, now there are ways to pay for it, it would be very expensive. People's taxes would go up.
Right.
I mean, that would be the trade-off, is that you wouldn't have healthcare expenses, you would have higher taxes. And I think one of the things that I worry about when you think down the line on that is that, high though the bills may be for premiums and payroll taxes and things like that, if people think it's going for a dedicated purpose, which is their health care, it seems a more rational way to be spending that money than if you just get a higher tax bill and it's going to the government.
Right.
Because then it seems diffuse and you don't know quite where it's going, and it's just like, you know, you're paying money to the government and, you know, it's not necessarily dedicated to your health care or whether it is. So I worry that the transition, even if you accept the fact that you could raise taxes and make that trade-off that you wouldn't have health care expenses, people always want to complain about something. What they would then complain about is they have astronomical taxes, and I'm not getting anything for this.
Well, but you're right that if you can tie it, right, the key to getting a major health care expansion finance is to make it very clear that maybe a new tax is dedicated.
There's got to be a dedicated tax.
A new value-added tax. All the revenues going toward, you know, an add-on value-added tax, not to replace the income tax system, but an add-on where the revenues would go to pay for COVID.
I want to jump in real quick, because I feel like we've focused almost exclusively on moving toward a universal health care system or an expansion of Medicare. and sort of sidestepped the kneecapping that occurred with the ACA over the last several years. And I want to go back to the idea, or even the question, is there a way to get the private sector more affordable as opposed to moving to an entirely government-managed or government-run system? For instance, is the inclusion of the traditional employer-employee relationship in how the healthcare system is structured, is that in law or just industry standard? And maybe we can incentivize a more groupthink perspective on healthcare that disconnects from the traditional employer-employee relationship.
I think so,
yeah.
And I think that's a very good goal, but I wouldn't use the term groupthink, which is generally thought of as a negative thing.
Right.
But that was the purpose of the ACA, and I do think that there are ways in which you can move the current system towards a more a competitive approach, towards a more cost-efficient approach and a consumer-driven approach. And I think that's not as exciting in some ways, because you get into the weeds about incentives and delivery and, you know, things like that. So most of the focus in recent years has been on innovations, and there were experiments in the ACA in order to make the current system more efficient and you know, less, so we can cover more people at a lower cost.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an abrupt shift to a new topic, but it's a question I wanted to ask. Are we having, with our demographic shifts, are we having any kind of labor shortages anywhere? Is it a result of demographics? Is it a result of jobs being shipped to other countries that might have cheaper labor? Is it a result of automation? And if any of that is the case, how do we start to address it on either a government or a private sector perspective?
Yeah, so I think that the demographics, the overwhelming effect on labor shortages has been in the healthcare field. It's, you know, the hands-on health services jobs like physical therapists, occupational therapists, health aides, nurses, those hands-on healthcare jobs are in the greatest shortage, and it's a problem from both the supply and demand side of the market, because obviously we have more and more old people who need more and more of this physical health care assistance, and that's driving the demand side of the market. On the supply side, it turns out that a lot of our like nurses are aging out of the workforce. It's sort of like government workers. The same thing's happening with government workers, and the younger generations are not quite replacing the retiring healthcare workers. It's a constraint that is, exacerbated by the fact that apparently the bottlenecks are often at the educational institutions, because nurses are choosing to work in hospitals rather than in teaching institutions, and because hospital jobs are more lucrative. So there's constraints as to how many people can be enrolled to study in nursing schools now. So this is one aspect where immigration policy is necessary, because there's actually a surplus of nurses in other countries that want to come work in the U.S. and have traditionally come over on certain types of special employment visas. But those visas have been restricted even more so lately, and they've always suffered from having these per country limits that are a little bit nonsensical from an economic perspective. So yeah, I think this is one case where immigration policy has to work together with employment and economic development policy, and that we see that at the local community level. There are nonprofit organizations that are bringing together the business sector with the education sector, with the community groups, to try to, there's an organization called Welcoming America, to try to bring together and better integrate immigrant workers into local communities all over the country. I do think that this is the reason why there's this demographics are so important for the labor market, is because It affects supply and demand. If you look at the kinds of jobs that have been offshored or automated, they're the manufacturing jobs. They're the very rote, repetitive jobs. They're even like, you know, even tech jobs, like programming can be done anywhere in the world for any company here in the U.S. So if you think about the skills that are needed for the jobs that can't be replaced by robots or moved offshore, those skills need to be emphasized more in the educational system. We need to be encouraging people to go into kind of more human service fields and work on interpersonal relationships rather than just math skills. Math skills are great and important, but we need to also encourage our children to develop relationship skills.
I have a broader question just going off of that, Diane. How do you go about incentivizing in the education system students to acquire those skills that are needed for industries that are in need? And on the flip side of that, it also seems like a reality that generations ahead of me are staying in the workforce longer for a variety of reasons, but perhaps they're staying in dying industries. How do you educate those individuals or move those individuals into those maybe human services or a growing industry versus one that's sort of fading away?
Well, I mean, this is a huge public policy issue. I mean, there is a role for government in this problem. Like, if people are not adequately incentivized to move into these fields that should be paying higher wages over time, but maybe are a little stubborn to come up in wages because a lot of these jobs are held by women who actually don't move as much to respond as much to higher wages as they do the overall quality of a job. I think that if private sector economic incentives are not enough, government should be in there subsidizing. Government needs to send the, you know, a stronger economic signal and encourage people by, you know, more scholarships for students that study certain fields in college, subsidies to employers who send their workers to, training programs to improve their skill set in terms of being able to work in more of these human service jobs. Subsidizing communities so that they can afford to pay for an adequate human service workforce. So I think this is where we need a role of government, because there are, of course, natural spillover benefits from these types of jobs apart from the private benefit of the wages that they pay. One point I'd make that ties it back to financing our retirement age programs is that one way to keep older people both in the workforce and healthier cognitively is to encourage local government, community-based volunteerism. It might not have to be purely volunteer, like that you can actually pay people a small wage to do something like become a foster grandparent at a local elementary school. So I think that this is a new trend that we're seeing pop up in many communities across the country, which is to get people, older retirement age people, more involved working with people of different generations and being productive.
I'm all for that. Keeping old people in the workforce is a really good idea. I get more fond of it every year.
Well, I'm glad you do, because I think for my generation, it often can result in this sort of backlog of progressing through careers because there's nowhere to go upward within organizations. But that's not a criticism of the Conquer Coalition any capacity.
What was that?
Turn the hearing aid up, Bob. Well, that's a good note as any to end the show and probably my job. This is Facing the Future. I've been talking to Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim in our recurring segment, The Economist Mom. We've been discussing real-world policy and program changes for the evolving economy. Thank you both for joining the show once again. And Diane, again, congratulations on your marriage to Bill Gale.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chase.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.